Okay, Shavuot Tov, everyone. I hope everyone enjoyed your first Shabbos of Daylight Savings Time and enjoyed it benachas. It's in some ways, it's hard to believe it's the third of these drushas that have been done via Zoom. And it's even harder to, I guess, believe where we were 1 year ago, just trying to adjust to everything going on, trying to figure out how we were going to do Pesach under these circumstances. So we've learned a lot. We've come a long way in many ways. This year, thank God, the shul is open for Pesach. And hopefully most, if not all of us, can safely celebrate with others this year in a way that we did not previously. I just want to say from the outset, if this will impact anybody's choices, that of course we still cannot let our guard down, that we have to follow the guidelines of the law, of medical advisors for how and when together, our Pesach should be celebrated safely so that we can celebrate more Siddurim together. And I think it's important to remember that this will come to an end. There is a Geula in sight, Yirtzeh Hashem. But just like the Geulas Mitzrayim required some patience, this does as well. And we hope to keep as many people as safe as possible and get to that finish line. The goal for this year is not just to give a Shabbos HaGadol drasha, but I'm calling it in some ways a Shabbos HaGadolim drasha. Since this time last year, we have lost so many leading sages of our generation, and I'll name a few, but I'm inevitably going to have missed somebody: Reb Nachum Rabinovich, Reb Yehuda Herzl Henkin, Reb Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Reb David Feinstein, Reb Meshulam David Soloveitchik, Reb Eliyahu Bakshi Daron, Reb Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, Reb Yitzchak Shiner. More locally, Rabbi Yehuda Kellermer of West Hempstead, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, just one neighborhood over, both of whom were nationally renowned leaders, even as they impacted sort of our closer area. Some of these materials were COVID-related, some were not. But losing a Talmid Chacham is like losing a base Hamikdash. We talk about this in the Kinos. That the death of a righteous one is like the destruction of Beis HaMikdash. And we've been affected very powerfully this year. How many Batei Mikdash have been lost this year? Well, again, of course, it's not Tisha B'Av, and we're approaching a time of great Simcha. But the loss of Beis HaMikdash is on our minds in Pesach. In fact, the four questions are changed, because there was one question mentioned in the Mishnah, Shabuchol Halel is Anu Ochlin Basar Tzali Shaluk Vuvusha. Halayla Zeh Kulot Tzali. So other nights we eat roasted and cooked, but tonight we are just eating roasted. And what's missing at our Seder is a Korban Pesach, because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. And we talk about it, but you know, when we get to Rabban Gamliel, we don't pick up the Shinkbon. We talk about it. It's not the real thing. And the implications being that Maror is Derabanan, Korach and Afikomen is just a reenactment, but it's not entirely the real experience. So there's something that we do mark the loss of the Beis HaMikdash on Pesach. And one of the central mitzvahs of the night is that we should tell your children on the night. And the sages will add a lot to that mitzvah. And the sages add a lot to the Seder. We have the sages at Bnei Brak, who we talk about. They shape the paradigm for what the Seder is, for how we fulfill that mitzvah we got to Levincha. How do we know what to tell our children? Because Chazal and the sages in every generation afterwards helped us frame what the Seder is about, the Torah that we should pass down. And they remind us that we all have something to learn. And furthermore, in order to teach Torah, we have to know as well. And it's the greatest sages in every generation who help that generation of educated Jews and give insight. And in that respect, I think we've lost a lot this year. But fortunately, the sages we've lost this past year, many recorded their Torah insights in general and their Pesach insights. And tonight, I want to share the Torah of four particular sages. And I'm going to just introduce them now very briefly so that we can launch into the Torah without breaking for biographies. I'm not going to, I was going to say more about each one, but I think almost everybody here can use Wikipedia as well as I can. So you're welcome, of course, to Google if you want to learn more. The first and this is not in any particular order, the insights will come sort of as they naturally appear, but Rabbi Jonathan Sacks was born in London. He was a philosophy major in college and came to Jewish learning a little bit later. Notably, he was very influenced in Jewish leader by Rav Soloveitchik and Lubavitcher Rebbe. His own Rebbe was Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who passed away just a few months earlier than he did. He was, of course, the chief rabbi of England from 1991 to 2013. He wrote a book a year for 30 years. And he was a real spokesman for Judaism, for religious values, and also for religious humanism in general. And he had so many relationships with so many different types of religious leaders because he was able to speak that universal language of God. We also remember Rabbi Norman Lamb, born in 1927. His grandfather, Rabbi Shua Baumel, was a noted posek. He learned in Tar Vadas and YU. He was the only individual who received both smicha and a PhD from Soloveitchik. And then he was a rabbi, most notably of the Jewish Center for many years, and the president of YU. And I'll share that every Shabbos the past number of months since Shavuos, really, I've been reading his drushas, masterfully crafted with fresh insights, timely and timeless messages. These first two sages that I mentioned might be particularly thought to be intellectual and within the bounds of modern orthodoxy, but the truth is they both spoke broader than that, and they also both had very deep neshamos, that they strove to move people emotionally, not just to give them knowledge, but to move them emotionally. Rabbi Sacks was notably very taken to music, was something that really spoke to his neshama. Rabbi Lamb was very taken by Hasidus, so it's important to note that even when we talk about the intellectual achievements of these individuals, they were also very deeply emotionally connected to Judaism. And I say that also because the next two sages I'm going to mention have a more Hasidish bent. Rabbi Abraham Twersky of the Chernobyl dynasty originally went into Urbanus just like his father and many ancestors before him. But he wanted to have more of an impact as a counselor in the emotional health of people's lives. He enrolled in medical school. There's a beautiful story for how that was paid for. That's not for now, but he became a psychiatrist, worked with people with addictions. And he wrote 60 books. And I don't remember who said this, but somebody said that they heard him say that really all of his 60 books were really the same book about building self-esteem, which is obviously very, very important. And finally, Rabbi Dean Steinsaltz, born in Yerushalayim, also grew up secular, but his father didn't want his son to be an Amorite, so he received a robust Jewish education and became more attached to Judaism through Chabad, was close with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, founded many unique educational institutes, and his motto was, "Let my people know." Very relevant for Pesach. I'll actually share that when it comes to his Agada is actually, it's terse. It's not full with his own insights, but really just trying to explain Shan the Gemara, Shan Haggadah, a few different approaches. And I think that's actually a good muster for the Seder, that sometimes we think we have to come to Magid and we have to spend hours and hours sharing this Vartara and that Vartara and that Vartara. But we shouldn't lose sight that there's an actual story that Chazal gave us to tell. And we should just try to understand what's going on there. We should try to understand the basics of that and work our way through that. So I said that there are four sages that I wanted to discuss, but actually there's a fifth. Just like there's a fifth cup at the Seder, you have the Arba Lashonos Geula, but the fifth one is really Vehevesi. And there's a fifth son, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, the son who's not the Seder. And there's a fifth question, which I discussed. So it happened to be that I found, after I advertised the Drusha, I found a Haggadah of another sage who passed away. He was actually one of the first to die of COVID. And that was out of the Novominsker Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Perlo, who was born in Brooklyn, learned in Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, also went to Brooklyn College, was a Rosh Yeshiva at Breuers. And then he became the Rebbe of Novominsk and created his own yeshiva. He was a Rosh Agudas Yisrael and the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. So very, very important and impactful individual in American Judaism. And I think it's also important to really to give him a lafa karsatov because he was really at the forefront of warning the Jewish people about the dangers of COVID early on. And unfortunately, at that point, it was already too late. He ended up catching it and passed it on. But he really deserves a lot of credit for that. So these individuals were ginormous leaders in defining Judaism and preserving Jewish identity in modern times. So I think it's important that we pay tribute to them, that we remember their writings, but also remember that the core beyond their intellectual of what they were about was about continuing the Jewish people, making sure that those Pesach traditions, the Vigata Levincha, passed through every generation. And from their writings, I really want to focus on two areas. Number one, what role do questions play at the Pesach Seder, more specifically and more broadly, about what it means to be Jewish? And second, how do the questions of the four sons in particular form the foundation of what Pesach, and again, by extension, what Judaism is all about? I mentioned that the major mitzvah of the night, Yigadata Levincha Bayom Ahu Lemor, shall tell your children on that night, saying, Bavur Zeh Asa Hashem Li B'Tzeiti Mitzrayim, because of this Hashem did for me when I left Egypt. So what do questions have to do with any of this? Right? We emphasize questions throughout the Haggadah. We start with Man Ishtana. What do questions really have to do all of this? We do all sorts of tricks to get kids to ask questions at the Seder. Right? Why do we dip twice? Maybe because it's so the kids will ask questions. Anyway, the formal four questions, everything is about questions. But the mitzvah is to tell the story. The mitzvah is Vigata Levincha, tell the story. So if you tell kids a bedtime story, so you're not sitting there trying to make them ask questions. I mean, you're trying to get them to fall asleep. You're not trying to get them animated and excited to ask questions about the story as you go. So why are questions so important? And one approach is that questions are in fact inherent to spirituality, which may feel counterintuitive. We might sometimes think about emunah and spirituality as just sort of knowing very simply that I'm doing what Hashem wants and that's it. But Rabbi Abraham Twersky notes that before the printing press existed, lay people were often kept in the dark, when, particularly in Christianity. They were told what to do and what to believe. There was dogma. That's how things went. And when scriptures began to be printed and people started to know, they acquired more knowledge. And that knowledge led to more questions, because the more you know, then the more questions you start to have. You're trying to figure out, you're trying to make the connections and try to figure out how everything comes together. Rabbi Sachs notes that Socrates was executed for encouraging questioning. And actually, it's very touching that Rabbi Sachs quotes Rabbi Twersky himself, that when Rabbi Twersky was a young student, his teacher would welcome questions in the classroom. And the more demanding the question was, the better. But sometimes teachers, they don't want the hard questions. They just want to tell you what the information is. They don't want to deal with the hard questions. But the truth is, in true Jewish learning, the better, the sharper the question, the better it is. Rabbi Sachs also quotes the Nobel Prize winner, whose name is eluding me right now. When some kids went home, their parents would ask, "What you learned today? Did you give any good answers to your teacher?" He was asked, "Did you ask a good question today?" And the truth is, the Jewish people always had the mitzvah Talmud Torah. We've always been learning. We've always been trying to learn, and learning in the original. We didn't wait till the printing press. Learning has always been the core of what we were at, but we arrive at God's truth by learning and by asking questions. The whole Gemara is about asking questions. Unlike the Shulchan Aruch, which you might think that if the oral law was to be communicated, like the Mishnah, it should just be phrase after, you know, it should be point after point. But the Gemara, which is what is primarily learned in yeshivas, the whole enterprise is about asking questions. And therefore, if the Seder is supposed to be a spiritual night, then we're obviously going to begin with questions. Rabbi Lam has a beautiful idea that the Seder is about tradition, right? Everybody has their family traditions, which tunes they sing and different ways that they act out different parts of the Haggadah, maybe some shtick that they bring along. But some people may not like tradition so much. Right, do your own thing. Why is everything so ceremonial? Right, why are these customs relevant? So Rabbi Lam says, how do we react to this kind of questioning? And he says, we shouldn't be perturbed. We shouldn't be perturbed. Questions are okay. We might feel challenged, we might feel on defense, but we shouldn't, because questioning is characteristic in his words, of an alert and intelligent mind. In Judaism, questions are not asking questions are not a sign of faith, but a lack of depth. If you don't have questions, then you don't have faith. Then if you don't have questions, then you don't have faith. You don't have depth. And it's not just that we welcome inquiry, but we also welcome challenge. Right? There's a difference between asking a question and bringing challenge. And again, that's obvious in Talmudic learning, but Rabbi Lamb notes that in Yiddish, it's not, and I'm not good with Yiddish, so I hope I'm not butchering this. It's not the fear shilas, but the fear kashas. Kashas, not shilas. It's questioned, it's challenging. And indeed, Rabbi Lamb says, the very questioning of tradition is itself a tradition. So let that sink in for a second. Part of the reason why we ask questions at the Seder is because Jewish tradition is about asking questions. And we'll have to talk about the Russia later, but just, you know, just to foreshadow for a second, I kind of wonder, you know, why is the Russia coming with these challenging questions? Russia is actually doing exactly what Jewish tradition wants. It's a tradition to pose challenges. It's a tradition to be challenged and to be thinking people. That is a sign of intellectual depth. And Rabbi Sachs elaborates on this point by noting that the heroes of Judaism and the heroes of faith ask questions of God. And the greater the prophet, the harder the question. Avraham Avinu famously challenges Hashem at stone and says, are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50? What are there 45? He's challenging and questioning going down the line. Moshe questions the persecution of Bnei Israel. Why have you brought this treachery upon the Jewish people? Lama hariyot elam hazeh. And Yirmiyahu also asks the question, why do the wicked prosper? Madua derech Hashem salecha. And Eov also grappling with good and evil. The heroes of Jewish tradition are the ones who ask the hard questions. As Rabbi Twersky says, questioning is at the heart of Jewish spirituality because faith is spiritual. And religious faith may often seem to be about naivety, about being blind and accepting. But he says that is not the Jewish way. Judaism is not the suspension of critical intelligence. That's what Jewish learning is about. He says, we ask not because we doubt, but because we believe. We believe and we want to probe deeper, we want to understand. And part of the Seder is about the generational aspect, begat halavincha, and children are the focus. And this is where Rabbi Sachs notes that Judaism is a Yerusha. There are two words for inheritance. There's Yerusha and there's Nachla. They both mean inheritance. Nachal is a stream. Nachal goes, the stream goes downward. It's just merely handed down. But Yerusha has a similar shortage as what it means to conquer, lehorish. And when Bnei Israel and Sefer Yeshua, they come to Eretz Israel, lehorish. Horishu, lehorishu. And we encourage active sinking. We're conquering. We're trying to learn. We're trying to find ideas, intention, and bring them together and conquer that. That comes by asking questions. Judaism is Yerusha. The Seder is Yerusha. Passing down from generation to generation, the Zaydi and the children and the grandchildren. This is what it's all about. It's about the questioning. Rabbi Twersky says that also, another important insight, that the importance of asking questions at the Seder is that we can live with conflict. We can live with conflict. He criticizes that somebody who's on the sort of the inside of psychology and psychiatry, he criticizes what he saw as a modern psychological trend to resolve conflict, to banish stress. And truth is, I think we're all sort of guilty of that in some ways. It's very hard for us to cope with uncertainty and stress and conflict and conflicting ideas, inconsistencies. But in fact, an inability to live with conflict and stress is what leads, in his mind, from his experience, he actually says that the inability to live with conflict and stress leads to substance use. And he says it impacts divorce because life is full of contradictions, uncertainty. And by asking questions, we're able to better live with that. We're able to recognize what that is, right? I'd add that we ask the questions year after year, almost as if they haven't been resolved, right? After a certain number of years, ask the same questions, you get the same answers, then we know already. But by asking them year after year, we know that things are complex, that things are conflicting, that things are complicated. And we see, and this is represented by the very symbols of the Seder itself. Matzah is both lechem oni and geula. It is the bread of affliction and redemption. We eat maror right after and right before we're drinking four cups and reclining. So are we celebrating? Are we memorializing? Are we marking? Redemption is about remembering the evil. And Rabbi Twersky says the answer is that we do not need to reconcile all conflicts. Torah freedom includes the capacity to live with stress and to be able to achieve serenity in the face of conflict. And finally, Rabbi Steinsaltz writes that we think sometimes the questions are bad because it shows we don't understand. I might be embarrassed to ask a question because I'm afraid of sharing that I didn't understand, that there's something wrong with me because I didn't understand the first time it was said. So I'm afraid that maybe I don't know something and my question is a stupid question. So is it okay not to understand? And Rabbi Steinsaltz says yes, because questions are holy because they reveal insight. And that's really the reason why questions are spirituality, as we've been trying to say, is because when we ask questions, when our mind focuses on something, we're able to sharpen something, we're able to bring out the truth, we're able to reveal that which was hidden. So here we are, we ask questions, and this is central to the Seder. And there are actually four sections in the Magid section, and they all include questions. But tonight I want to focus in particular on the four sons. Kids are very perceptive. They don't hold back. If they have a question about something, they ask it. Sometimes a little bit too impulsively. Sometimes it's like, wait. But kids are perceptive. They ask profound questions. They say what they think. And they have different kinds of assumptions, perhaps. Everybody comes with assumptions. But sometimes when adults enter a space of learning, so they come with all the assumptions of whatever they have, the kids come with fewer of those kinds of assumptions. And therefore, they're able to perceive things, notice them, and ask about them. They call attention to it. And that's the beauty of the four sons being featured in terms of asking questions. And these four sons are not just four characters that exist in one time, but they're archetypes who say a lot about Judaism and the Jewish people. And we'll see that perhaps the Chacham, we think that maybe the Chacham Rasha are often sort of related, the Tam and the She'enu Yodei Lishol are related. We'll see that maybe the Chacham She'enu Yodei Lishol are kind of opposites, and the Rasha and the Tam are opposites. They're chiastic, but they all kind of really interrelate. So we're going to go through the Arba Banim, and my window closed, I was just realized it, but I wanted to post the four sons as I read it, so just bear with me for 1 second. I'm going to, I think that's probably so easy to use. Four sons. Okay, let's share. 3, 2, 1. Okay. Chacham Mahu Omer. What does the wise one say? Ma ha'idot v'chukim v'mishpatim asher tziva Hashem Elokeinu etchem. What are these testimonies, statutes, and judgments that the Lord commanded you? And accordingly, you will say to him, as per the laws of the Pesach sacrifice, we may not eat the afikomen, a dessert or other foods eaten after the meal, after we are finished eating the Pesach sacrifice. This is the question of the Chacham and the answer to it. And Rabbi Twersky notes that the Chacham is not asking a question about the Seder. Not a question about the Seder, right? What the laws of the Seder are necessarily. But there's a broader question. What's the significance of mitzvahs in general? And why are so many related to Yitzias Mitzrayim? We have Shema and Shabbos. Why are so many different, Tfilin, Tzitzis, why are all these related to Yitzias Mitzrayim? And so the answer is that you can't eat after having Korban Pesach. That's what we respond. Why are so many mitzvahs related to Yitzias Mitzrayim? Because you can't eat after the Korban Pesach. What is that about? What's going on here? And the answer is that it has to do with spiritual liberation. Yitzias Mitzrayim represents a rejection of paganism. Egyptians worshipped sheep. And I would add that more broadly, paganism, and when they come to Eretz Yisrael, they're also trying to destroy paganism, right? Yitzias Mitzrayim was escaping one form of paganism, going to Eretz Yisrael, and destroying more paganism. And I would add that one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, which, of course, the Ovdei Avodah Zarah don't keep, is you're not supposed to have Eivir Min HaChai. you're not supposed to have a limb from a live animal, right? So if you want to indulge, you want to eat meat, that's fine, go ahead. But there's a process. Our Torah tells us that you have to shech the animal, and if you're having a korban, you don't eat it right away, but you frame it as a ceremony to God, that it's not for my indulgence, it's not for my taking, but I have to stop, acknowledge God to do something for the act, I have to slow myself down there. And in this way, by rejecting paganism, rejecting Egyptian lifestyle, we distance ourselves from materialism, from self-indulgence. And Rabbi Tversky Rebbe and the Novodvinsky Rebbe say that the point of not eating after the Korban Pesach, of not eating after the Afikoman, is that this taste of spirituality must linger. We must savor it. We must remember it. We are never free from risk of seduction. We are not allowed to, we may not be able to sacrifice the Korban Pesach right now, but we sacrifice other opportunities of Torah and Kedusha for other goals that might distract from the goals of spirituality. And we need that time of the Korban Pesach to linger in our mouths to last. It's not just about lasting on the night of the Seder. It's not just that night, but all mitzvos that we do, the reason why we have so many mitzvos that relate to Yetzias Mitzrayim is because we constantly have to remember that Yetzias Mitzrayim was a rejection of indulgence, of materialism, of paganism. We want that taste to linger at the end of the Seder, that the Korban, that our sacrifice is that of the Korban Pesach, that we sacrifice for Torah and Kedusha, that we get rid of paganism in order to come closer to Hashem. And the Novodvinsky Rebbe says that the Chacham loves mitzvos. We see how many mitzvos are related to Geula. He's happy. He sees it's a s'chus. So that's the spiritual liberation, is that I'm rejecting paganism. And even though I might think that the self-indulgence is good for me, the truth is that it's not. It doesn't give me more meaning. So I allow that taste to linger. I'm thinking about Yetzias Mitzrayim all the time. And also, again, that the Chacham shows his love for mitzvahs, that there's so many different mitzvahs that I want to learn about them. I realize how many are related to the Geula. That brings more meaning to my life. Rabbi Sachs notes that the pasuk brought by the Chacham is from Devarim, whereas the other pasukim that are said in relation to the other sons are from Shmos. And Devarim is 40 years later than after Shmos. And Rabbi Sachs writes there that historical understanding takes time. In the midst of events, so we are too close to see their significance, even to ask the right questions. Which I think is a very important point, because we're often so quick to analyze that we don't even know the right questions to ask. But already, 30 seconds after an event takes place, the pundits are on TV and everybody's debating on social media, on taking to Twitter. Everybody's reacting, making a statement, declaring that something's historic. But the Chacham is reminding us that that true wisdom is not reacting in the moment, it's not the knee-jerk reaction, but it's trying to understand everything, the complexity, taking everything in, analyzing it. Obviously, we don't take 40 years to analyze everything that comes our way. But it is very important to develop wisdom through patience. And that's again, as I said at the very beginning, that Yetzias Mitzrayim itself was about patience. That you might think you're in a situation and you're being told that God's supposed to save you, and you're asking when, and this is taking so long, and why is Paro keep hardening his heart? It's a process. And the Chacham understands that everything is a process, everything takes time. I want to move to the time. I'm going to skip the Rasha. I'm going to come back to the Rasha at the end. But I'm going to skip to the Tom, and I want to quote primarily from Rabbi Lamb when it comes to the Tom. Yerushalmi calls the Tom a tipish. The Tom is a fool. It's an intellectual statement. But the Akedat Yitzhak, Rabbi Yitzhak Arama, explains that the Tom is an ethical religious type. It's not an intellectual type. We might think that the Tam is somebody who is not learned, they're simple, they're unsophisticated, simplistic. But let's think about this for a second. Who was the Tam? Yaakov is an Ish Tam Yoshevo Halim. Is Yaakov unintelligent? Is Yaakov unsophisticated? And I'll add that, and if anything, it was Esav. Right? Yaakov's an Ish Tam compared to Esav. Esav is perhaps more simplistic. And I would add that we have other characters in Tanakh who are tamim. Noach is an ish tzadik tamim hayabat Torah tav. So on the one hand, he's righteous, but he's a tamim. And Hashem tells Avraham, "Hey, talach lefanav yeh tamim, be a tam." Is Hashem telling Avraham to be stupid, to be unsophisticated? And in positive environment, it's a mitzvah, tamim tiyat im Hashem lokacha, to be tamim with Hashem. Is that being simplistic, unsophisticated? None of this is telling us to be parv, to be unthoughtful, and to be foolish. It's a mitzvah to be tamim. We don't denigrate Avraham. We don't denigrate Yaakov Avinu. So the tam is not a tipesh in our Haggadah, but the tam is the opposite of a rasha in terms of ethics, in a certain way. But the tam is also, he's wise, but if anything, wiser than the chacham. They're both intelligent people, but they're intellectually different sides of the same coin. Here's the difference between the tam and the chacham. And again, the tam, you know, different than the rasha, of course, where it doesn't have that same anger, cynicism, and the like. But the tam is different than the chacham also, because he might be a learner, but he doesn't display his learning on a sleep. He's not getting there by asking clever questions. Rabbi Lehrman writes that the ultimate test of both humanity and Jewishness, an essential guarantee of their survival, lies not in ideal thinking, but in real living. The tam is unimpressed by intellectual acrobatics and prefers heart over mind, faith over philosophy, dedication over dialectics, love over learning. What's the characteristic of the tam? The tam doesn't need to become close to God by being a genius and by displaying his genius, and that Avodas Hashem is only through that. But the tam also realizes that it's important to have a neshama, that it's important to have faith. Tam means wholesome, a wholesome understanding of God. One of my colleagues, Avraham Maz, is a rabbi named Rabbi Pesach Somer. And he's, for years, he has a wide audience who reads his social media posts and his blogs. And he's been saying for years, and the first time I spoke to him over the phone before I came to Ramaz, he said to me personally, that we have to think about what it means to give a Jewish education that's relevant to kids. We might teach vocabulary and how to read a Gemara. We might teach them the facts and the content of Judaism. They might know how to daven. But do they identify with it? Do they see God in their lives? Is it relevant at all? Does it mean anything to be Jewish? Is it just something that school teaches us? Or is it something that somehow relates to who I am and what I do? The chachma might be there, right? We might know a lot. But there's no guarantee that that chachma is going to lead to a continual connection to God. You need something spiritual to latch onto. You need to think that what I'm doing is meaningful and relevant, something that elevates me. That's what's going to connect people to Judaism. And this is true for adults as well. Story goes, I heard this directly from Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, who's rabbi of the Eish Kodesh in the Five Towns, that when he first came to be what was called Mashpia, he was going to be a spiritual guide at YU. He was debating whether or not to do it. Right? So I guess it was before he decided to do it. This was while he was thinking about doing it. So he's in Shul, and Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who's a Rosh Hashiva at YU, was in the Five Towns, comes to Eish Kodesh. Rabbi Tendler gets an aliyah, and he goes up to Rabbi Weinberger, and it's not characteristic to speak. And then Shul, but he says to Rabbi Weinberger something, "You have to come to YU. Why do you have to come to YU? Ki chayla sahava ani. I am sick for love." It's a pasuk from Shir HaShirim, meaning I'm desperate for love. I'm desperate for love. It's one thing to be intellectually engaged and to learn Gemaras and to know and to think. But if we're looking for God, we need more than just the Yeda. We need more than just the content, but we need the Ahava. We need the Tmimus, meaning that wholesome faith. Even somebody, again, I mentioned at the beginning that Rabbi Sacks obviously was an intellectual giant. And yet in his funeral, one thing that was done besides the spading is that one of his friends was a chazan, sang the song "Tzama Nafshi Lelokim." My soul thirsts for Hashem. The tam is not less intellectually competent than the chacham necessarily. Avraham and Yaakov We're not stupid. But without the basic connection, the question of the Tam is mazot. What is this? The Tam just wants to understand, what does it mean to believe in God? I realize I didn't actually read what the Tam says, so let's read it very quickly. Tamahu omer mazot. What is this? And you will say to him, with the strength of his hand, did the Lord take us out from Egypt, from the house of slaves? If I don't understand the basic of what it is that I'm doing, it doesn't matter how many Rashi Tosos I know, how many Blat of Shas that I know. But if I don't understand fundamentally Mazos and what the purpose of being Jewish is and why God took us out of Mitzrayim, what I'm doing, it all stays up here. But it doesn't bring me any closer to God. It doesn't bring me any closer to connection. And Rabbi Lem further notes that the Chacham and the Tam are actually switched in the Yerushalmi. In the Yerushalmi, it's switched. The Chacham is told that God took us out with an outstretched hand, but the Tam is told that these are the laws. And Rabbi Lem notes that perhaps it's going to be in a surreal time when the Chacham is regarded as a Tam and vice versa, that the Tam will get the accord of the Chacham. So why are we switching these? So I'll read you what he wrote. He says that there's been a confusion of roles and titles, hasn't there? We live in an age when countries dominated by a small, fanatic, militaristic clique promenade as peace-loving democracies, while the only enlightened democratic country in the Near East, one which needs peace for its very survival, is condemned as an aggressor and a bastion of imperialism. Again, Rabbi Lam's words are timeless. Who is it who is applauded as a chacham, and who is it that dismissed as incongruous tam in our times? Is a learned author regarded as a chacham and the ignorant Jewish entertainer a tam? Or is it perhaps reversed? Who is acknowledged the superior? Who is acknowledged the superior wiser man? The devoted scholar who can barely make a living? Or the shrewd operator who can make a successful killing? Who is ridiculed as a tam? The man who is monogamous and moral? Think the way Mike Pence was ridiculed for his following Yichud, right? Who's ridiculed as a Tom, the man who's monogamous and moral, or the one who follows the fashion of our sexually liberated society? Apparently, polyamorism just became legal in a couple of states. It's a Navi here. Who is heralded as a Chacham in the circles in which many of us move? The principal person who refuses to speak ill of another and runs a risk of discoursing on subjects boring because unconnected with scandal? Or the inside dopester who has the latest information, right or wrong, about every potential sensation and who traffics in rumor and rechilu. People can be very, very smart, but without a certain sense of a tmimus of understanding Hashem's values, everything can be warped. Everything can be intellectually turned over its head. German society was very cultured and civilized. And that carried through. It didn't stop in 1933. They killed Jews. And they go listen to classical music at night. So sometimes the Chacham is actually the Tam, but the Tam, the person who is a Reish Shamayim, is actually the Chacham. So the idea is not that the Tam, what the Tam is, not that it's just blind faith or it's just intellectualism, but the wholeness of personality. It's taking the Chachma and the Tmimus together. We've emphasized that people who ask good questions have depth. People ask good questions have depth. And that's true. But there's a Mishnah Pirkei Avos that says, Kol she'yiras chayto kodemes chokhmaso, chokhmaso mikayemes. If my fear of sin precedes my chokhmah, only then does my chokhmah persevere. Because if my chokhmah comes first and my wisdom comes first, it can take me in all sorts of directions, all sorts of challenges that lead me away from God. I can justify all sorts of things. I can manipulate. Even Torah can be manipulated by a chokhmah. But somebody who's a tam, who's fundamentally a tam, somebody who has a Yiras Shamayim, a Yiras Chait, so that person can learn and become learned also, but then the two come together. That person is not just a Chacham, but a Yiras Shamayim as well. And Pesach reminds us that before we learn the details, we have to know the Mazot. We have to know what this is that God took us out of Egypt. Very basic understanding of what it is that we're here for, what it is that we're about, what our values are. That is the Tam. Sheino Yodei Lishol. You open for a conversation for them. And you will speak to your son on that day, saying, for the sake of this did the Lord do for me in my going out of Egypt. Right? Chorsky says that the She'eno Yodea Lishol, somebody who doesn't analyze, they don't reject, but they don't even question because there's nothing that even stimulates their curiosity. They hardly reflect on goals in life. Our lives consist of work, rest, relaxation, entertainment. Not necessarily bad, not necessarily evil, but hollow and empty. No thought on a higher purpose or something beyond self-gratification ever occurs to such a person. And if one tried to even convey such a message, it would fall on deaf ears, not because that they're defiant, but because the whole concept is something alien to them. Not an evil or an ill in society, but also something that holds us back, that it leads us at a lower level. It doesn't bring us closer to God. It doesn't bring us closer to values. Lahavdil, Rabbi Chorsky says that in his clinical work, he saw people who would be addicted to alcohol. But they function, they go to work, they have good family ties and friends, never accused of drunk driving. If you try to say to them, maybe you're drinking a little bit too much, you can't reason with them. You can't convince them until, unfortunately, becomes relevant, until they confront the consequences. And again, I think Lahavdil, which Eino Yodea Lishol, says Rabbi Chorsky, you have to wait until the Sha'a Shiyesh Matzah Mar Munachim Lefanecha. You have to wait until the Matzah Mar are in front of them, until he can palpably sense the bitterness of being a slave to one's physical desires and can perceive that there may be some value in spirituality and being liberated from the tyranny of one's bodily strivings. She'eno Yodea Lishol, again, isn't bad. But somebody who's not thinking, somebody not thinking about growth, something, how do I want to continue to improve my life and live a more meaningful life? And in some ways, it's a very sort of harif statement, right? Harif as the mar itself, it's a very sort of sharp thing to say. But there is a message here that certainly Torah doesn't resonate with all people, and some of that has to do with apathy. And our job at the Seder is to shake people out of apathy, which is very, very difficult. But that's a job. There's so many causes in the world and people don't pay attention to until egregious events happen, and then all of a sudden everybody responds. Right? So there could be evil unfolding in front of our eyes. We're very aware of what's going on in the world, but we're kind of stuck at that She'eino Yodea Lishol stage, that we're not ready to speak out. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to let it hit us until all of a sudden something boom magnanimous is going to happen. All of a sudden we respond. And the same thing spiritually also. We think we're spiritually fine. We're going through life. Maybe we're happy. We plateaued in a certain way. And we're She'eino Yodea Lishol until the Matzah and the Mara come in front of us. They stir us to go higher. And now you just have to put out in front of them. Put out the Matzah and the Mara. And the message of that is for us to sort of get a taste of what it means to live a more exalted way of life. To live a little bit higher. A little bit of a different take that Rabbi Chorsky offers is that of Rav Hirsch of Rimanov. Rabbi Hirsch of Rimanov said, take my word for it, the one who doesn't know what to ask comes away the best. The one who doesn't know what to ask comes away the best. So what does he mean by that? Rabbi Chorsky gives an example that he was at a spirituality weekend for recovering addicts. And then there's a woman named Bernice who speaks up. And she mentions that earlier that morning, she wanted to join the davening. There was a minyan. She wanted to come to services, but she doesn't know how to daven. And she even tried coming into the sanctuary. She wouldn't know what to do. So she didn't want to come inside. And that's what she shares. She reflects. She was a little bit upset, but not really sure what to do about it. So Rabbi Chorsky says that what God sees when we walk into shul is a bunch of greedy people coming in with more selfish requests. Right? We're all asking for things that we need. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't, but a lot of us come to shul asking, ready to ask God for things we need. But who's standing outside? God sees this woman, Bernice, desperate to daven, but not knowing how. And she's in agony because she wants to come closer to me, says God, but doesn't know how. So Rabbi Chorsky says to her, whose prayer is more sincere? Me, who is davening for my needs, or you, the silent one, wanting to come closer to God? That's a different take on the She'eino Yodea Lishol, but a very inspiring one. But sometimes that the She'eino Yodea Lishol is the one who maybe didn't have the schut of having a strong Jewish education, doesn't necessarily know a lot about Judaism or a lot about God, but sort of like the Tam, that if you open up and you give them an opening to come in, you let them in, they'll take it because they want it, but they just don't even know where that opening is. The Kutzke Rebbe, I think Rabbi Sachs quotes this, that the Kutzke Rebbe has a famous line. Says the Torah in Shema, that these things should be placed on your heart. Why is it on your heart and not bilvavecha? Al vavecha, not bilvavecha. Because sometimes they just stay on your heart until you're willing to let them in. Aptachlo. At the Seder, we're opening up and trying to let that spirituality in. So I guess similar, Rabbi Lam notes that Yishayin Oyodeh Lishol, there are three types, perhaps. There's the unconcerned, the morally apathetic, the drowsy, kind of like what Rabbi Tversky said originally. There's the embarrassed, the intelligent but afraid to ask. That was like the second version. And then there's also just the assimilated people who are smart. They're not unsophisticated, but they don't necessarily have the background. And what's the solution? At Petachlo, you must initiate the dialogue. Make him feel welcome. Open up our heart with warmth or love, never an anger or attempt. Right? Maybe it's easy to see the Rasha and the She'eno Yedei Lishol, I believe, are given the same pasuk. Actually, there's a similar pasuk that's quoted to them. And you might see them as the same. Right? The people who are apathetic might appear as being the Rasha. But that's actually not the case. But they need our warmth. They need us to open up. We reach out to them. That's what outreach is about. And he says, don't overly focus on history, theology, and philosophy. But what is Judaism? What is unique about Judaism? The actual mitzvot, the practicality of all of that. Bavur zeh asah Hashem li b'tzid Mitzrayim. Tell them that this is simply what it is. Rabbi Lam notes that sometimes people might despair because they might think it's too late. It's too late. But even we were once idol worshippers. Mitzchila hayu avoteinu avdei avodah zarah. We say in the very next part of the Haggadah. We were once idol worshippers also. Not all of us were born into this. Avraham Avinu wasn't born into it. But we grew spiritually. And every human being started as a She'eno Yodei Lishol. So he writes, any Jew returns to Judaism today, despite complete lack of background, recapitulates Jewish history and his adventure and romance with Judaism. The She'eno Yodei Lishol just need to give them an opening, let them in. We need to stir them. We need to put out the Matan Torah. We need to tell them that this is what they want. Right? Which is actually, I was listening recently to an interview with a CEO of Timberland. His name is Jeff Schwartz, I think. He says that sometimes the secret behind business, right, Apple's secret, is people don't know what they want. They have to tell them what they want. They have to put out the Matan Torah. We have to open up. We have to initiate. We have to tell them what they want. The Novo Minsker focuses finally at She'eno Yodei Lishol on the fact that the She'eno Yodei Lishol, we're talking about a child here. And maybe a child is too young to even ask, but you have to embed with them the rock solid emunah, give them a root to grow from. He writes, each one of us from the youngest, most immature child through the wisest, greatest sage must live through the experience of this night to fully achieve what is expected of us. A bedrock emunah that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim in order that we become his nation, a nation of Avdei Hashem. And how do we do that? The Rashi explains on this pasuk, you have to give words, not the intricate laws and the analyzation, but stories, legends, beautiful ideas that will stir the heart of an individual. We're not supposed to engage, we must not just engage impressionable minds, but as we said with the time also stimulate their hearts. Make them want to have ambition. Make them want to learn before they learn. That because before one learns, one has to want to learn. The time I tell you that they want to learn, the time I tell you that you want to learn them, and then, you know, that's how you get the time to that level. But the She'eno Yodei Lishol might show a lack of interest, or they might not even know that they're interested, but you open up and tell them something that will inspire them. The She'eno Yodei Lishol is somebody who's laden with potential. And they might be in a state where it seems like that they have no interest in any of that, that they're happy where they are. But you give them an opening and maybe they will be inspired. Maybe there's a way to give them that inspiration, bring them up. That is what they are doing at the Seder. And so finally, I want to address the Rasha. Everybody wants to understand what the Rasha is doing at the Seder. If there's such a Rasha, what are they doing here in the first place? Why didn't they leave? And how do we treat the Rasha? It's a little bit, the way that Gada formulates it is kind of interesting. And maybe some of us are even wondering if I'm the Rasha as well. And the Gada sort of sets up this disdain for the Rasha by calling him the Rasha, by showing that he's a separatist. Right, let's see what the Rasha has to say. Rasha mahu omer, ma havadot hazot lachem. What is this worship to you? Lachem v'lo lo. He says to you, but not to him. Ulefisha hotzi etamo min haklal kafar beikar. And since he excluded himself from the collective, he denied a principle of Jewish faith. Ba'af atak had shina v'emor lo. And accordingly, you will blunt his teeth and say to him, Bavor se'as Hashem li b'tzeiti b'mitzrayim. For the sake of this, did the Lord do this for me and my going out of Egypt? For me and not for him. And if he had not been there, he would not have been saved. This sounds very, very harsh. But on the other hand, the Rasha statement itself seems a little bit extra, a little bit harsh. So our premise at the beginning of the Rasha was that questions are good. Questions are meant to encourage us to deepen our faith. So if that's the case, we got to ask ourselves, what's so bad about the Rasha? We should be able to explain Ma'avodah Zot Lachem. We should be able to answer that. We shouldn't be perturbed by the challenge. Maybe it's a challenge, but it's a good challenge. We should understand what this is all about. Why do we assume that everybody understands why Judaism is beautiful, why Judaism is important, why God's important? Why not just answer him? Give him the answer. Okay. All right. Hopefully we're still going. Okay. Last time it was a lack of energy that I had to switch devices. Although now I'm back on the computer. And this time it's a Wi-Fi outage. Okay. I was just getting fired up. So why do we assume that the Rasha understands everything? Why don't we just explain it to him? So many say that maybe it's a way he asks it, that he's cynical, that he's disdainful. In an essay called Servitude to Freedom, this is not in his Agada, but this is in a separate collection of essays from Steinsaltz, I think he actually says what the Rasha's question is about without saying so explicitly. Steinsaltz asks, what's the essence of slavery? What is slavery all about? What is slavery all about? Almost everyone labors hard and with all their energy to earn a living. In fact, I was talking to people this morning after Shul, and it seems like everybody is stressed at work. Everybody has a lot going on. Everyone's very busy. And there are very few people who don't work under some sort of time pressure or non-optimal conditions. Most people work hard, maybe don't make a lot of money. So the life of a free person is similar to the life of somebody in servitude. It's even hard labor. This is what Rabbi Steinsaltz says about servitude. And what I see in there is really the Rasha's question. How is your life any different as a free person than a slave? You slave in cleaning for Pesach and cooking for Pesach and stuffing your face with the so-called kezayis of matzah in 3 minutes without talking. What's this all about? You're still a slave. Barry Tversky notes that if you want to celebrate an Independence Day, you want to celebrate leaving Egypt, so have a parade, have fireworks. I was reading a drasha from Rabbi Lamford, Vayikra, also poses the same thing. The difference between Vayikra, Hashem's call to Moshe, and Vayikar, Hashem's happening to Bilam, is that Moshe sees Chag HaMatzos, Chag HaPesach, that there's obviously something, you know, meaningful and there's divine providence in Pesach. But Bilam sees, and somebody with a Bilam attitude, somebody who sees history as circumstance, sees Pesach as a liberation holiday. So it should be Independence Day. It should be 4th of July. And why have a deadline to wake up every morning to come to Shul to say Kriyat Shema on time? I'm very tired every morning. Waking up at 5-something in the morning to get to Shul at 6:30. What do I need that for? Say Kriyat Shema on time. Can't travel the world, enjoy the food, the harchakos, and beyond of Nida, that restriction between husband and wife? Who needs that? How many books do I need to tell me what I can and can't do on Shabbos? Just rest, watch TV, enjoy yourself. And in some ways, it's not even that different for me as a rabbi. I mean, thank God I recognize the meaning that I do, but you know, it's not like I was vegging on the couch this week. Pesach is our busy season. Drushas, Shiloh, selling chametz. This is our festival of freedom. So Rabbi Steinsaltz says the difference lies in the content of slavery. Slavery is when labor is done for others. Someone superior tells you what to do. And it makes no difference if you're working with brick and mortar or whether you're sitting in an air-conditioned room writing literary essays, which is something that's kind of hard to grasp sometimes. But you know, we can be sitting in ostensibly comfortable conditions. Externally, it seems great. You might be making a great salary. I think of starting lawyers that they work like dogs from 5 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. They're making a great salary. They might move on to a great career, but it's coercion, it's servitude. It's not pleasant. But slavery goes deeper, even that, when it's internalized. And that's the difference between slavery and true freedom. If slaves forget their independent identity and they identify with servitude, it means that the slaver has penetrated their soul. Right? The answer to the Arba Banim is Mitchila of Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu. But then we became a monotheistic. And then we come to Egypt and there's 49 levels of impurity. And that was a real test. When we fall into the 50th level of Tumah, and the answer is that we see the Tumah for what it is, then we remain redeemable. We know that our slavery is just coercion. We know that there's a paro, there's a tyrant. But as soon as we believe in Egypt and its idolatry, we buy into it and we say we'd rather go back to Egypt. I wrote a Vartara once on Shach Lecha that when the Chet of Meraglim, when they say they want to go back to Egypt, that's a Chet of Avodah Zarah because they want to go back to that lifestyle of Avodah Zarah. That's internalized servitude. And this is the significance of Moshe's request to worship Hashem in the wilderness, because at that point, that's when Paro knows that he failed. Because Bnei Yisrael believed that there's an ultimate master above the master. Paro was hoping to break us, to think that there's no other purpose in life, that we just do the monotonous work day in and day out. There's nothing to aspire for, nothing to hope for anymore. And it's not that the Russia wouldn't have been brought out of Egypt. He would have been brought out, but it says he wouldn't have been redeemed. He would have just seen life as going from one form of work to another form. He would have gone from working for Paro to working to farming in Eretz Yisrael. It's also hard work. So he would have been brought out, but his soul would have been wanting. He wouldn't have been internally redeemed. So the Russia is right in a certain sense that if we don't have a unique identity, we don't have a purpose in life, then in fact, ma'avodah zo lachem, it's meaningless. What's the point of it? But our freedom is because we came out of the purposeless life of being slaves in Egypt to be avdei Hashem. And that has meaning and purpose. And Rabbi Lam says that this is the difference between the Chacham and the Rasha. The Chacham wants to know responsibility. The Chacham wants duty. The Rasha thinks that all responsibility is bad. He doesn't see that responsibility ennobles. Right? The famous, I don't remember when Rabbi Lam says this, but Rabbi Lam, of course, lived in the time of JFK when JFK said, ask not what America can do for you, but what we can do for America. The Rasha doesn't see things that way. Russia thinks that America is about my freedom and taking and benefiting from the capitalism of America. Whereas the Chacham understand that there's a dot chukim mishpatim, that our responsibility is to God. My freedom comes with responsibility. And this leads us so finally to Rabbi Sachs's modern rendering of the Russia. Rabbi Sachs says that the wicked child can't really be wicked. You call him a wicked child, but he can't be the wicked. In fact, Rabbi Lam says, there's no tzaddik child. So if the Rasha is the opposite of the Chacham, it's not really that he's wicked. He might be ignorant, he might be indifferent, right? There's a theme here. The Rasha, again, is asking the same question that Sheino Yodei Lishol doesn't even realize that they want to know. In some ways, Rasha is a little bit more aware of that. He might be a little bit ignorant, apathetic. I'm not sure if they really want to buy into it. But maybe they're not so horrible. Rabbi Sachs gives five proofs that the Russia isn't horrible. Number one, no Jewish parent wants to believe that their child is evil. Right? That's why there's an institution, the Ben Sora Mora in the Torah, that if you have a child who's rebellious, that maybe they'll be brought out, they have to be executed. But the Gemara says that never happened and never will happen. So no Jewish, and part of that is because both the father and mother had to bring them out, then they wouldn't do that, perhaps. So no Jewish parent really believes that their child is evil. The second thing, reason why the Rosh isn't so horrible, is they're supposed to set their teeth on edge. And Rabbi Sacks says, really? Is that the best way to deal with a child who's a little bit rebellious? Can't be. And the third problem is, how old is this child? I thought this was like, I never thought of this, but I love this idea. If the Rasha is under bar mitzvah, and we're criticizing the Rasha, saying, well, if the Rasha is under bar mitzvah, the Rasha is not obligated to mitzvahs. So it is lachem v'lo. He's not obligated in any of this. He's not commanded. And if he is bar mitzvah, so Rabbi Sacks quotes the halacha that you're not allowed to provoke your adult son with a harsh answer. You're not allowed to chastise an adult son because they'll end up rebelling. So what kind of child is this anyway? This child is truly a Rasha. What's going on here? Number four, why doesn't the Haggadah just says tochiach oto? Why is it there's a strange language, hakach enough? And number five, there is actually a pasuk in Yirmiyahu that says that the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. V'shinei banim tikhena. So the question is, did my sour grapes set my child's teeth on edge? In other words, did I cause this child to be a Rasha? Maybe the Rasha, there are issues. But is it the Rasha's fault or is it my fault? So let me read what Rabbi Sacks says. It's very, very powerful. We're getting to the end momentarily. What is the child whom mothers see as wicked? The adolescent, the rebel, the breakaway, really signaling by his conduct. We know what he says. But what is the question beneath the words, the inarticulate cry? Father, mother, what does Judaism mean to you? You sent me to Hebrew school. You gave me bar mitzvah. You hired teachers for me. I know what Judaism is supposed to mean. I listened to the lessons. I read the books. But all the time I was growing up, you sent me mixed messages. When I neglected my secular education, you were angry. But if I missed my Hebrew lessons, you never seemed to mind. I learned about the laws of Jewish life, but I did not see you observe them. Or if you did, you did so selectively. You said Judaism mattered. But what you did seemed to show that did not matter very much. In my bar mitzvah, you were concerned about the catering. You're more concerned about the catering than about how much I understood the words of what I said in synagogue. As I grew older, you seemed more interested in which college I went to, which career I pursued, than whether I was continuing to study and practice Judaism. You wanted me to marry a Jewish girl, but you never gave me a real reason why. I know what Judaism is supposed to mean, but you are my parents. I am Jewish only because you are. So I ask you from the depth of my soul, what does Judaism mean to you? Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem. And whether we're dealing with an actual child or we're dealing with ourselves, the child within us, the Russian ourselves, our job on Pesach night is to ask, what does Judaism mean to me? All these children, the Chacham, the Rasha, the Tam She'enu Yodei Elisha. What we see really tying this all together is that all are deep down yearning for an answer to that question. Ma ha'avodah hazot lachem? What does this mean to you? And when you can tell me what it means to you, maybe I can learn what it means to me. And this is why we have to set the Rasha straight. But we do it with love. Because at the end of the day, they're asking a very profound and important question that we have to be able to answer. And once we can answer that for ourselves, we can answer that for others. And this is how I want to end, that the life mission of these giant Rabbanim was to stir our souls and to ask us, what does Judaism mean to me? How does my freedom allow me to forge an authentic Jewish identity and enhance my sense of purpose in life, that it's not just about fulfilling my basic needs, but that there's a noble purpose in being God's partners in creations. The message of Pesach is not about bricks and mortars and leaving physical slavery. We went to Eretz Yisrael and we worked hard. We serve Hashem with halacha. That's all work and labor. But our challenge in every generation is to reject the paro that tells us that our lives are purposeless and about self-gratification, about abandoning our identity to fit in with the world that seems more rewarding and less demanding. We have a unique history, a history, a value system. We say in the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, "Ein ben chori ela mi she'osek b'talmud Torah." Who's somebody who's truly free? Somebody who's engaged with learning Torah. The only free Jew is one who is in day in and day out engaged in the unique character and heritage of Torah, because that is what ennobles our soul. That's what makes us come closer to God. That is why we wake up every morning and say Moda Ani. Our job is to find what the Torah is telling us that makes us unique, that contributes to perfecting the world in God's image, my role in it, and what's special that I can contribute for the sake of society. And our job is to model it, and not just to preach it, but to believe in its power ourselves. These leaders all loved Jews. Even those who said Ma'avada Zolakhan, they were all dedicated in their unique ways in bringing people who were not so close to Judaism far away. Every single one of them had a role in that. But they toiled to remind us that our Avodah is not the Avodah Perech of Egypt, but the uplifting, soul-warming quest to come close to God. They taught us that there are ideas that might be appealing, lifestyles that are comfortable, but not as enriching. But our job is to live ethical, value-driven, and disciplined lives in which serving God is the most meaningful thing we could possibly do for ourselves and for the world to come closer to God. That is why we are freed. And those are the questions that we are seeking for ourselves to unearth to give us that meaning on Pesach night. Wishing everyone a Chag Kasher and Sameach.